Hello and welcome to Zero Hangout. Today I'm joined by a special guest for an interview. His name is Ian Munro and he is the author of Between the Flags, Making Sense of 57 Years of Heartache. Hello Ian, welcome to the show.
G'day, good to meet you.
Thank you. So tell us about Between the Flags. It's a really interesting book, making sense of that 57 years of heartache for the Melbourne Football Club. I'm a big Melbourne Nuffy, and I assume you are as well.
Yeah, you have to be, I think. Look, the thing about the book, I lived it before I wrote it.
Yeah.
So I went through those 57 years. Mm-hmm. The reason I wanted to write it, I actually wanted to understand what went wrong at Melbourne, because when I grew up, they were dominant. They almost never lost, mm-hmm. and they competed in grand final after grand final. Then they fell off a cliff. And they fell off and they went down and stayed down for many years. So I wanted to explore the reasons why there was that amazing plunge. And to do that, I had to look at what changed in football pretty much for every club, because there was a change in the recruiting rules in 1967 that upended the league. And that affected Melbourne. But to understand why it affected the Melbourne the way it did, I had to look at how it affected every club. Mm-hmm. So within the book, there's this examination of the impact of the introduction of country zoning that continued from 67 until the beginning of the national draft in 86. And that reshaped, as I say, reshaped Hawthorn, turned them into a powerhouse, helped Carlton become a dominant club, stopped Essendon being a successful club for a period until they got some really good country recruits. In the late 70s, you know, Tim Watson came through, people like that, and they recovered. But for other clubs, it was a disaster. For Melbourne, it was a real problem. They had a very poor metro zone. They had a lousy country zone, probably the worst country zone.
Mm-hmm. So where was that zone? For those that don't know, zoning was brought in as an equalisation measure.
That's right.
But it didn't quite work out that way. So we were only allowed to recruit from certain country zones.
And that's right. Yeah. Melbourne had the Goulburn Valley.
Yeah.
Collingwood had arguably the most difficult zone to work. And that, I think that was deliberate, because Collingwood was a powerhouse, mm-hmm. and it was about equalising the competition. And although the zones were supposed to be assigned randomly, what you saw is that the clubs at the bottom in 67, like Hawthorn, Footscray, North Melbourne, did really well out of it. They got strong zones. Hawthorn got Mornington Peninsula. Footscray got Latrobe Valley. North Melbourne got Ovens and Murray, which was a really powerful zone at the time. Collingwood got southwestern Victoria. And some of the clubs they were supposed to recruit from were actually in South Australia. So they had a really tough zone to work. And Richmond, who were powerful at the time, they got a difficult zone, which was Merbein. Merbein Mildura, it's called Sunraysia. You can't go further and still be in the state of Victoria than to go to Mildura. So the clubs that were strong at the time tended to get these difficult zones, and that's supposed to be random, but I think it's probably suspicious.
Yeah. Mm. So why were they – let's go back to before they brought the zoning in. Was this because – did they bring it in purely because, you know, Melbourne did have that massive sustained period of success?
Pretty much. It was mainly aimed at Collingwood, Essendon and Melbourne. Mm-hmm. If you look at after the Second World War, in the 22 seasons or 23 seasons after the Second World War, Melbourne, Essendon and Collingwood made 28 appearances in grand finals. Mm-hmm. They're often playing one another. Now, the competition was more even then. There were other teams that were able to win premierships, but those three dominated, and they dominated country recruiting. Mm. And so what they wanted to do was to give what Ron Joseph told me were considered the peasant clubs a fairer share of the player market. Mm. And so that was essentially what it was about. So it was the first bit of football socialism. You know, I remember when the national draft and the salary cap came in, John Elliott at Carlton was moaning about football socialism. But what he didn't understand is that Carlton was one of the main beneficiaries of the original football socialism, which was country zoning.
Yeah. And they cheated the salary cap. So it all balances
and
out.
And so did Melbourne.
So one of the things that struck me when I was reading the book was as a sort of a younger fan. I obviously wasn't there for that sustained period of success in the '60s. I didn't really get to know the characters that are a huge part of the history of the Melbourne Football Club. So your names are like Ron Barassi, Norm Smith, Bluey Adams. Those names, you know, I've heard them a lot, but I didn't really know that much about them. And then like what I liked about the book is that you do go over some of those like interesting little stories. Like I didn't know that Ron Barassi actually lived with Norm Smith for a period of time when he first got recruited.
Yeah. Well, in fact, what happened was that after his father was killed in the war, his mother remarried and moved to Tasmania. And at that point, Norm Smith offered to house Ron and build a bungalow in the backyard of his house in Preston so Ron could live in that. So, an incredibly close relationship and probably a unique story in terms of Ron's connection with a particular club. I don't think anyone's quite woven into the fabric of their club the way Ron was.
And, of course, Ron was a big reason that the – or I think the reason that the father-son rule came in.
Yeah, that's right. Melbourne lobbied for the father-son rule because of that connection with his father being killed during the war and his father being a premiership player with Melbourne.
So speaking of lobbying, there is another interesting section and big part of Melbourne's history is the proposed merger that almost happened. So I went through that part and I didn't realise just how close that actually was to happening. So can you tell me more about the Demon Alternative?
Yeah, well, the Demon Alternative was a supporter group that just grew out of an office in South Melbourne and an ad in the paper. And the first time I went to one of their meetings, there was about 20 people there.
Yeah.
And they were hoping to take on the AFL, the might of the AFL, and stop the merger. And I really wasn't optimistic about what they'd be able to achieve, but they actually did create an extraordinary presence, even though people were, the media generally, were very sceptical about them initially. They found it hard to find a voice in the media, but they did an extraordinary job in terms of marshalling genuine supporters who were opposed to the merger. And I mean, the thing about that whole affair that stays with me is how unreliable that particular vote was for all the reasons I go into in the book. You know, you've got directors of the Melbourne Footy Club buying memberships for employees and asking them to vote for the merger. So in effect, inviting non-Melbourne supporters out of loyalty to their boss to see the club merge. Now, we were lucky Hawthorn opposed it and their vote knocked it off. That left us with the stain of apparently supporting a merger. But I think anyone reading that chapter would find it difficult to accept that that vote was accurate.
And you, at the time, you were covering it as a journalist because you start to – this is sort of the period where you start to weave yourself into the story of the Melbourne Football Club a little bit as well.
I didn't cover the merger.
Okay.
I was doing other stuff in journalism at the time. But I did think Rowan Connolly did a really good job in seeing the writing on the wall as to how the thing would unfold. I was working in the same office as Rowan at the time, but I didn't – cover that at all. I did start working with the Demon Alternative when they were just getting started, but then when they became newsworthy, I had to pull out of it because I was going to have a conflict of interest. So I withdrew from the Demon Alternative basically once Gutnik came on the scene, and once they were newsworthy, I didn't want to actually be in a situation of knowing something there that they were planning and not being able to tell my office about it. So I pulled back once Joe was on the scene.
So after the merger, you know, we skip through and we get to Neil Danaher. It was a huge part of the club. So that's sort of when I sort of, because I was born in 93, I started to come online during that 2000 grand final. So could you go into a little bit of Neil Danaher's impact on the club?
Yeah, Neil was tremendous. The key thing about Neil is that he started classes. You know, he actually had a series of rules, and not just rules but also scenarios. When this is happening, we do this. When that's happening, we do that. It was the, I suppose it was the beginning of modern coaching, which you see a lot now. And I think the outstanding thing that Todd Viney talks about in the book is that nothing in Neil's training was generic. Everything was designed to be how you would play. Mm-hmm. And so it was a lot of scenario-based stuff. But right at the beginning, classroom lessons and then exams.
Yeah.
And one story that didn't make it into the book, Russell Robertson told me that Gary Lyon and a couple of others stormed out after the exams because Todd Viney scored top marks, and they couldn't believe that Todd, of all people, I don't know what they had against Todd, but apparently Gary Lyon threw his exam paper in the air and said, you know, this is bullshit or something to that thing, and walked out. And it was one of the stories that didn't make it into the book, but it was a funny one. I think David Schwartz talks about the exams as well. It obviously had a huge impact on the players. It was something they'd never encountered, and that was really innovative of Neil. And I tell the story in the book how when I turned up to interview him at Caulfield Grammar, there was a series of instructions on a whiteboard and questions for the players, and I started reading them. And as soon as he saw me reading them, he flipped the whiteboard over. That was sort of, you know, that's purely inner sanctum stuff.
Yeah.
And, yeah, you're here to interview me for the club, but we're not going to be mates, and I'm not going to let you in on any of those secrets. So he was a bit jealous of what he was doing, but he was tremendous influence on the club. And I think the thing that people have to understand, for all that he achieved, it was done against the odds. They didn't have proper equipment. They didn't have proper gym equipment. That had to be hired. They didn't have a proper place to train. You know, they were training in the middle of Albert Park, not on the Junction Oval. We were nomadic because we'd been kicked off the MCG in about 1982, couldn't train there. We had a series of summer training sessions at either Beach Road, down at Trevor Barker Oval, Elstonwick Park, Caulfield Grammar, as I said. It made things incredibly difficult for people like not just Neil but John Northey, and, you know, John Northey's before your time, but he was, for me, the man who gave the club back its self-respect. You know, he dragged us up. We'd had 5 years with Barassi coaching, which hadn't worked out. And 2 years later, we're in a preliminary final with John Northey. And it was an amazing roller coaster ride. And something I did want to say about those 57 years, it is 57 years of heartache, but it's not 57 years of misery. Mm-hmm. It was a great roller coaster ride at times. There were huge emotional highs. You know, that 87 campaign was just captured the imagination of the whole city. Mm. And even 88. Okay, it ended disastrously with one of the biggest defeats in grand final history. But then that didn't wreck the club. Port Adelaide got smashed in the grand final like that. You didn't see them again for several seasons in the finals. Melbourne bounced back the next year. And the year after that, they stopped Hawthorn going for a triple premiership. So that was an amazing, amazing period under under Northey as well.
We'll fast forward through to for me, definitely the lowest point of Melbourne Football Club, and probably like something that formed me as a person, I think, was that Geelong game in 2011. One thing that I didn't know about that game was in the week prior, they actually had that meeting with the leadership group. So can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, that was probably a massive mistake to involve the players at that level. Mm-hmm. But the starting point was an interview Brad Green did on Talking Footy on the Monday night, where he said, we've got problems at the club we have to sort through. And that set off alarm bells. The players were called into a meeting to find out just what was going on. And I think that was on the Thursday night before the game. It's difficult to talk about all the details of that because there are so many egos involved, but essentially the club was being mismanaged at a football level. There was interference with the football department, and the players got drawn into it. I don't know how they played as badly as they did because they weren't that bad. At that point of the season, they were still in contention for a final spot. So it was incomprehensible to me how that game played out. But it was a real low point, but there were worse. There was worse to come. That's the amazing thing. I mean, the Geelong game, 187-point defeat, that was massive. But what came 2 years later when Mark Neild was coaching, I think was worse.
Mm.
You know, you just couldn't see a way out of it at that point.
That was a really interesting time with Mark Neild. So what was your what went wrong there? Because it was just the wrong people at the wrong time.
Yeah, they got the coach wrong, essentially.
Yeah.
And he, I think he messed up his approach to the players. He came in with a particular mindset. And in the words of some of the people I quote in the book, he brutalized the players verbally.
Yeah.
And he was looking for, I guess, a pushback. But what Paul Roos found when he got there was that the players didn't need to be challenged in that old-fashioned way. They needed support. I mean, they had been brutalised, I guess. A lot of senior players were alienated in that period. Aaron Davey talks about how he didn't enjoy his football at that time. Mm. And, you know, he was such a favourite for the club and so popular. There were other players who had quite senior positions who felt disrespected at that time. Often when a club is running as badly as Melbourne were at that time, people will say the coach has lost the players. Mark Neild never had them, and that was the problem, and it went from bad to worse.
Yeah. So Paul Roos comes into the club, and then that sets in motion pretty much a progress to the grand final, which we've covered a lot, but what was your experience of the grand final? Because it was a pretty interesting one.
Yeah. Well, I'd like a lot of people, midway through the third quarter, I was starting to feel pretty flat. I had this feeling, you know, when you start to feel things are getting out of control,
mm-hmm.
You get this sense of resignation. And I was just getting the first signs of that when James Harms burst away from that that boundary contest and put the ball out in front of Bailey Fritch. And that was such a special moment. Yeah. That was great. What happened after that is frankly unbelievable and I reckon unrepeatable.
Yeah.
But talking about unrepeatable, Max Gawn's game in the preliminary final against Geelong, that quarter he played, that is unrepeatable.
Yeah.
I don't think he'll ever do anything like that again. But he's been a great player just the same. But, mm-hmm. yeah, those two games were just extraordinary.
Yeah.
To take on a battle-hardened mob like Geelong were in that preliminary final and come out so far on top was just an amazing performance.
Was that, in your time supporting the club, is that the single best performance of a D's player that you've seen in a game?
I reckon it would have to be. Yeah.
It's pretty up there for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't think of anything that quite matches. Oh, well, David Schwartz actually could tear a game apart.
Yeah.
The 1994 version of David Schwartz was amazing. But look, there is someone actually, you forget these things. Jeff Farmer kicking 9 goals in the second half against Collingwood. That was amazing too.
Yeah.
You know, that was just, again, unrepeatable. And you have to keep in mind that he was playing so badly in the first half, he'd been dragged. And the player who replaced him initially looked good, scored a goal, broke his wrist, Farmer comes back on and just goes nuts. Yep. And there's a photo from that game in the book where Russell Robertson had this thing, you know, when there was a player streaming along the flank, you'd see Russell at the back of the pack signalling, you know, put it up, and he'll get the sit. And on this day, he got the sit. Farmer just leapt in front of him and snatched the mark away. It was just brilliant. And you can see in the photo, or if you ever watch the footage, Russell's saying something to the wizard afterwards. He wasn't happy.
He would have hated that.
So yeah, he would have hated it.
What is the most surprising thing that you discovered while writing the book?
Interesting. I actually think it goes back to the zoning stuff,
mm-hmm.
how transformative that was for the competition. I knew it had had an impact. I didn't realise it was the thing that basically made Hawthorn into a powerhouse. And in discovering that, I also discovered that St Kilda had planned to take that zone, which ultimately went to Hawthorn, that moved to Moorabbin. They were recruiting around Brighton, Sandringham. They were looking at the Mornington Peninsula as their home base. And their bad luck was that top teams were not getting the great zones, and they were the reigning premier at the time the decision was made. So you look at that, it changes the way you think about a club. Mm-hmm. If you're a Carlton supporter, you know, Carlton supporters at the moment are really on a high. They're kind of feverish and anticipating a lot of excitement. And I reckon that's founded in the experience they had in the 70s and 80s when they were the dominant club along with Hawthorn. And Hawthorn's fans at the moment, you know, they've got this, they're in a bit of a slump, but the ones I know, they all believe they're coming back. And that's rooted in that zoning period too. Yeah. So it changed it almost made the personalities of the club into what the clubs into what they are. Mm-hmm. So St Kilda's got, we all look at St Kilda in a certain light. We'd look at them very differently if they'd actually been able to fulfil their ambition of getting that particular zone. And we look at Carlton in a certain way, and that stems from that period as well, and Hawthorn.
Yeah.
And it was, I think probably the transformative character of that for the entire competition.
Yeah.
It's kind of like an example of how not to run a sports competition. Don't let the clubs run it.
Exactly.
And so when the AFL Commission, you know, they bring in another rule change or they change an interpretation and you think, God, why don't they leave it alone? But at least it's better than having the clubs run it because as an exercise in sports administration, the club's outcome was disastrous. In the 21 years before zoning came in, 9 different clubs won premierships. Mm-hmm. In the 21 years afterwards, only 5 won premierships.
Right.
There was about half the competition couldn't even aspire to success.
Yep. Beautiful stuff. So last question, how do you think the Dees are going to go this year? How are you feeling? I'm feeling a little bit more optimistic after the past couple of games. We've just come off a big win against Hawthorn.
Yeah. And a win against Hawthorn is always a good thing because they've punished us mercilessly in the past.
Well, you were at that game where we scored, I think, the lowest. Was that our lowest ever score?
Yeah. 3-11.
Yeah.
1966.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was terrible. That stayed with me because I was with Hawthorn supporters at the time.
Top 4 grand final, what are you feeling?
Oh, look, I'm optimistic of top 4. Like everything, it depends on injuries. You know, what we've seen since 2021 is Melbourne run into a series of injuries that have basically disrupted their season. Mm. We were really, it takes luck to win a flag. It's not just being a good team and being well organised and well drilled. You need a bit of luck, and that luck usually takes the form of injuries. And you look at our injury run in 2021, it was pretty strong. We lost Tomlinson early. We lost someone late as well. But the last 2 years.
Not Melksham. Yeah, it's Melksham.
It was Melksham last year we lost. So, look, the achievement last year, 2023, Melbourne have been looked down upon because they went out in straight sets for the second time, but they rebuilt their forward line 3 times during a season. Petty comes in, is a success, he's injured. Fritsch is gone for the second half of the season, comes back underdone. Mm. Melksham comes in, bolsters it, is a revelation, is playing some of his best footy. He does a knee. So the gods conspired against us. If the gods are kind, I think anything's possible.
Yeah. Sounds like a bit of a curse for a line there when you put it like that, but you're right. So, Ian, thank you so much for coming in. Where can people find Between the Flags?
It's in bookshops such as Readings, the Avenue Bookstore. They get it from Melbourne Football Club. And if they go to the website, betweentheflags57.com.au, there's a full list of shops there that are stocking it.
Yep. Beautiful. All right. We'll put a link in the description as well. Ian, thank you so much for coming in.
That's a pleasure.
Cheers.